Welcome to the Brass Spittoon, the podcast of the Front Porch Republic. We'll chew on issues timeless and timely, with a focus on place, limits, and liberty. I'm your host, John Murdoch. The Brass Spittoon is back. After several months dominated by moving vans and even a tornado, enough normalcy has returned to allow for the production of new episodes. I now come to you from the piney woods of East Texas, the land of my birth. For this first episode back, we start with the ending. Regular FPR conference closer Bill Kaufman joins me. We discuss his own journey there and back again to Batavia, New York. Thanks for pulling up a chair. Bill Kaufman, you're the author of a 200-page book entitled Look Homeward, America. And so it is with some anticipation and some trepidation that I maintain the Brass Spittoon tradition and ask you this podcast opening question. What does home mean to you?
Well, I'm glad you didn't say it was with dread that you answered, that you asked that question, John. Home, I guess, is a source of much of my identity. An inspiration, and I've written in defense of it. I think it's endangered. My home is a small city in the outlying area in a rural county at the western edge of New York State. Outsiders, visitors might think it unprepossessing, but to me, it contains all the drama and comedy and hope and agony that that one could ever wish to find. It means the world to me, you might say.
So, Bill, the genesis of this interview comes from Kate Dalton's introduction of you at last year's conference, where she described you as a man who needs no introduction. But it occurred to me that you actually might, at least for what we might call Porchers 2.0, those who have not been around this enterprise since the beginning. Not everyone knows how it came to pass that you were the regular conference closer, including myself. So how did you get that job?
I think in part it owes to the fact that Jason Peters has numbed the audience into a stupor by the time late afternoon rolls around, and he needs someone to wake them up. I think our first conference, actually, I looked this up, actually. First conference was 2011, and I was the keynoter then, and I must have bombed, so since I've been relegated to, batting last in the order, you know, like the light-hitting Enzo Hernandez-style shortstop. And also, I think it, I don't know, I guess I was present at the creation, so I guess they feel an obligation to keep me on the roster, not cut me, like the 40-year-old quarterback, you know.
So, Bill, the subtitle to Look Homeward, America is In Search of Reactionary Radicals and Front Porch Anarchists. Now, I've heard a rumor that our dear republic came close to being a virtual anarchy. Can you confirm or deny and give us your role in the origins of FPR?
I think we do have a fairly anarchic setup, but, the title... I got this from Jeremy Beer, who was one of the founding editors of Front Porch Republic. He told me that he'd been talking with Mark Mitchell, who's also a mainstay, one of the leading lights of FPR. And this would have been back, I don't know, probably 2008-ish. And Mark had this idea that for a website called Modest Republic. Jeremy, you know, the word modest, I don't know. When I hear it, I think of like somebody who doesn't think women should wear short skirts or something like that. So it was kind of a mashup, I guess, of Front Porch from my book, since there'd been a year or two earlier than that. There'd been, actually, let me go back a couple years. In 2003, there was a Liberty Fund conference in Savannah, Georgia on Wendell Berry. And Liberty Fund, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's just great. I assume it's still working. I haven't been invited in a while, but it was endowed by this Indiana industrialist named Pierre Goodrich, who was sort of this old right figure in the 50s. The idea, and he was, I think, kind of an autodidact, one of these voracious readers, like to talk about ideas. The idea was to get maybe 12 to 15 people. They tend to be academics or writers or journalists, whatever, together for a weekend. They always put you up at a very nice hotel, some city, somewhere in the world, and you just talk about things. And that's the point. There's no purpose. It's not like didactic or anything. And so anyway, there was a conference on Barry in 2003, and that's where I met Jeremy Beer, who was then editor-in-chief of ISI Books, and Jason Peters, who I joke about Jason, but Jason is a great wit, and he's, I think, probably the most cogent and sympathetic explicator of Wendell Berry anywhere. And anyway, so that's, he was a professor at Augustana College. We met there. We had a fantastic time. It was a great conference. Alan Carlson, I believe, was the convener. He's the great family scholar, Swedish-American agrarian from the Midwest. The one funny thing about that conference is these things are always collegial and friendly, but the invitees, the participants, are from a variety of points of view. And I remember in the last session, a woman, very nice woman, but she said that in her opinion, the thought of Wendell Berry leads to the Khmer Rouge, who murdered upwards of a million people in Cambodia. So that that caused a little bit of a tempest. Jeremy signed me up to do the book that became Look Homeward. And I think a year after that came out, we had a fantastic conference in Charlottesville, because you might say there are some Jeffersonian themes in the book. I know Jefferson, I guess, is supposed to be a bad guy now, but not in my book. Certainly the sort of the Ward, his Ward Republic ideas late in his life were very much in line. And so I think in some ways, some of the FPR stuff came out of that Charlottesville conference. You know, for a while, it was really going strong at first, and then it hit a lull, and it's great to see people invigorating it. I mean, there's new material most every day on the website now, and that's really exciting. I should also mention that Caleb, one of our founders, is now a justice of the Kansas Supreme Court. I'm sure he's one of the wisest jurists in America. So this is slowly and insidiously, FPR is taking over the, taking over the country. You know, today, Kansas Supreme Court, tomorrow, the Missoula City Council, who knows what's next?
Well, you're already, have thrown in a couple baseball references, and of course, you are a powerful man in that sport.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I swing a big stick.
Tell us about life as a baseball owner.
Baseball. Well, I'm not really. I was not an owner. I grew up about one block from the stadium of a team that in my youth was called the Batavia Trojans, now called the Batavia Muck Dogs. We were a founding member of what was once called the Pony League, later the New York Penn League, which is in the very lowest level of baseball's professional minor leagues. And obviously growing up, I spent a lot of time at the park. I was lived away for a number of years when I was a young adult. And since returning, I mean, I've probably spent 1,000 nights or so watching ball games there. It's the sense of community, I think, that attracts me about a ballpark. Never an owner, but we were a community-owned team, which is, I can tell you that in professional sports, that is the ownership model most loathed and detested by the people who run things, because they always wanted to kick us out of the league. You know, they wanted to bring in all these affluent, yuppie-ish cities in upstate New York and New England. And because our community owned the team, we were a nonprofit. To show you how far back this goes, it was created this way in 39, but in the 50s it reorganized, and a provision in our charter said that if ever we were dissolved, funds raised from the dissolution would go to combat juvenile delinquency. So I think that's kind of a lost, I think we lost that fight many decades ago. But anyway, we limped along, you know, as giving some soul, I think, to the largely soulless landscape of professional sports. But then COVID wiped out the season in 2020, and in the winter of early 2021, I think it was winter, maybe spring, the lords of Major League Baseball saw fit to eliminate several minor leagues, 42 teams, just wipe them out. And so we got, I think, sort of in some ways a promotion by demotion, in that We now have a team in a summer league. It's no longer unfortunately, it's no longer community owned. I was vice president of the community owned team, which I got to tell you, vice president is the greatest job in any organization. You have to do nothing.
Were there funerals you had to attend? What did you do as vice president?
No, there won't. I was always very mindful of the health of the club president, though. Yeah, so now I'm just a person in the stands, as I always was, sitting in third base stands, and I'm blessed. I mean, my family's gone to these games for years. My dad was a bat boy in the 1940s, and my parents are both in their 80s now, and still have season tickets, still go to the games with them. You know, you see I don't like to get mystical about baseball. It's just a sport, just a leisure activity, but I still see in the stands, I still see the folks that have gone before. Chesterton spoke of a democracy of the dead, and I think there's a sort of fandom of the dead too. And the great thing is that there are always new people coming, and there were never really class divisions that I sensed in our town. I think because it was small, somewhat insular, but whatever class divisions there are just dissolve, I think, in a baseball stadium. So you'll have the superintendent of the schools sitting next to the janitor, sitting next to the cashier at the supermarket, and it doesn't matter. To me, that's sort of the ideal America, and it still exists, I think, in a lot of pockets of the country. And so I've been lucky with baseball.
So how big is Batavia?
It's 15,000. At one point it was 17 or 18, but it is we've lost population. It's the county seat, the seat of Genesee County, which is one of the, I think, three or four counties in New York State that has more cows than people. To me, it's perfect size. Herbert Hoover once said that the ideal American city has a population of between 3,000 and a couple hundred thousand, maybe, where a person can make a difference and a person's absence would matter. And so I think that's the case. That's the case. Just the civic organizations we've been involved with. I mean, I've never had any political involvement up here. Though I write a fair amount about politics, used to even more, I kind of hold with Henry Adams that politics is a systematic organization of hatreds. And, I'm not really into that. So we've been involved, my wife and I. My wife's actually a native of Los Angeles. Been involved in, Landmark Society, which is a preservationist group, which was founded in the 60s when the city fathers actually took federal urban renewal money and knocked down a large part of our old downtown. The brick shops, churches, all these places where people had very meaningful events occur in their lives, and they just knocked it down. And so I think that's what really seeded my hostility to the federal government at a fairly young age. A significant number of the folks who are involved in these organizations are outsiders, born outside, moved in, and they sometimes see things that natives don't. Anyone who grows up in a small town, you hear people say, "Oh man, nothing to do here. Can't wait to shake the dust off the soles of my feet and get out." And so sometimes people come in from the outside; they have different angle of vision, and they're able to appreciate things that that the rest of us take for granted. It's certainly been the case in our county. In fact, as I said, my wife is from Los Angeles, and we had a Washington, D.C. was our way station before moving up here. But she adapted spectacularly. In fact, she was the we now live about 4 miles north of Batavia in the neighboring town of Elba, which is apt address for an exile, I guess. She was town supervisor for 2 terms before she didn't want to follow the FDR president for life model. So she thought George Washington would be a good he would be the better role model, so she stepped down after 2 terms. I was first man, and I could never figure out what my special project should be.
Just say no to what, right?
I was a pretty docile first man.
The first man of Elba. We have many titles. Well, as you mentioned, you followed something of the out and back pattern where, as you mentioned, you were in D.C., something we have in common. I did a decade in D.C. I was buried in the bowels of the federal bureaucracy as a civil servant, but I knew many of those 20-somethings that were running Congress for fast food wages, and you were one of those, and for one of the most, I would say, interesting figures of the Senate in the last half century. Tell us a little about your time in D.C.
Yeah, he was. I graduated college. I went to work first as a research assistant, later as a legislative assistant for Senator Pat Moynihan, the Democrat from New York. And it's funny, I mean, I always assume everyone knows who he is, but time passes, and sometimes people don't know. He was a bluster. He was the finest intellect in the Senate. He was a guy who always asked the right questions, though he was sometimes afraid of the answers. Served, was it four terms? I guess it was. And he grew more interesting as years went by. I worked for him about 2.5 years, fairly early in his career, when he was kind of a fairly standard New Deal Democrat. Though, as I say, he'd worked in the Nixon administration and the Johnson administration earlier for Governor Harriman of New York. In fact, that was one of my favorite. I guess it was probably before I was born, but. The year that Averell Harriman ran against Nelson Rockefeller for governor. So it was as if the plutocracy decided to just drop the facade and like, hey, look, we run this country, we run this state. And, you can choose between, Robber Baron A and Robber Baron B. But anyway, it was, to me, a seminal, pivotal period in my life. D.C. is great, or at least was great for young people. You know, a lot of unattached young folks who are looking for fun. And the Moynihan office was sort of intellectual cauldron. Moynihan himself was, I mean, like most powerful people, he was a prick, you know. To quote Henry Adams again, he once said that no man could be a senator or a priest for more than 10 years and remain fit for human companionship. And that was sort of the case with Moynihan, although, as I say, I have very fond memories of this period. And I think the weird thing about Moynihan is that years later, actually only a few months before his death in the early 2000s, I had lunch with him, another former staffer and I. He was doing this sort of visiting professorship at Syracuse University, which is a couple hours away. So I drove over, and with another ex-staffer, we thought we'd interview him. And now we hadn't seen him for probably 15 to 20 years. And of course he greets us like we're his long lost sons and all lads, blah, blah, you know, and Senator Moynihan liked to imbibe. So we've met him at, I think, the Sheraton Hotel in Syracuse. And it was probably like 10:30, 11 in the morning. Let's go to the bar, lads. So we go to the bar. The bar, of course, is closed. And in this dark bar, he just starts pounding on the bar, on the counter. Finally, he's a former senator, powerful man, so he's used to, people kissing up to him. So someone comes in, oh, excuse me, Senator, but the bar's closed right now. It doesn't open till whatever, noon one. Nonsense. The lads want a drink. So they open the bar for him. And the other ex-staffer was a teetotaler. So I thought, well, I guess I should, kind of keep up with him. I mean, I couldn't keep up with him. I had to drive home. I dropped out at 3. But it was just the most... He was so engaging, and I could see why. I mean, he was politically, he was unbeatable, and he never quite understood that because he'd been, raised like in the 40s, and he always thought like the American Labor Party was going to run a third party candidate against him or something. You know, he was kind of half Harvard Don, somewhat dotty but brilliant, and half like Irish drunk on the bar stool, And it was a fantastic combination politically. And we had a really wonderful time talking to him. It was great. The interview was largely worthless because after a while he started slurring his words. And at one point he's talking about 9/11, and he was calling it 7/11, as if Bin Laden had declared a jihad against Slurpees, and 7/11, oh, horrible thing, But we had a fantastic time. And so as the therapists say, it was closure. So yeah, anyway, so anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that I did live in D.C., enjoyed it greatly, but I was, after 2.5 years or so, I was really disillusioned. Essentially, it was an anarchist-making experience, and I thought I got to get out. So I thought, well, I want to go to the most atypical place in America. So I packed my stuff, and I took the Greyhound bus to Salt Lake City. I'd never been there. But the Mormons actually... Joseph Smith found the tablets in Palmyra, actually about 50 miles away. So I was kind of had an interest in Mormonism. My favorite football team has always been BYU, even though I have no Mormon connection. So I lived in a flop house for the winter and wrote derivative poetry in Salt Lake City. And I said, this is enough. I'm posing. So then I had a year in the PhD program at the University of Rochester, political science, and, under the greatest of all congressional scholars, Richard Fenno. But political science is becoming very quantitative, and I couldn't do a regression analysis to save my life. So I left, and I became an editor at Reason Magazine, which is a libertarianish magazine on the West Coast in Santa Barbara then. And from there, I went back to serve as Reason's Washington editor and met my wife, who had actually joined the staff of Reason shortly after I moved to D.C. So we spoke every day on the phone for like 3 months before we actually met. And we hit it off and got married. She moved out to D.C. And then after a while in D.C., I'd always been homesick all my life. And I said, how about if we move back to my hometown for like, it's like a one-year experiment. And that year has been measured in Old Testament Methuselah terms, because it's been over 3 decades now. She's made herself native to her place, as Wendell Berry would say.
You went through that career path as though it was normal, as though, of course, one would work for Pat Moynihan and then go work for Reason Magazine. But that doesn't seem the most normal. And then you, I believe after Reason, you worked at Chronicles for a while, the paleoconservative magazine.
I was an editor. I was obviously living up here, but I was an editor at Chronicles, and which was for a time in the 90s a really exciting magazine. And it was a let a thousand flowers bloom type place. I mean, I was obviously not in the wherever I've worked, whatever organizations I've been associated with the exception of Front Porch Republic, probably, I've been on the fringe politically of those organizations. So I would have been on like the peace and love left wing of Chronicles, and the sort of populist left wing of Moynihan, and the middle American populist wing of Reason. So yeah, but you know, as long as these places will allow me to write, to say what I think. I mean, I've found them all. You know, I could never be involved with a party line organization. And then one of the great things about FPR is that there's not a party line. Obviously, we all have a bias in favor of the small. Place limits liberty, as the motto goes. But you know, no one is cast out or excommunicated for violations of dogma.
It's an interesting lineup of employers that you have. I assume one reason that you were able to do that is you are a very interesting writer, but your style is not one that would often be recommended by English professors, I suppose. I think of the literary saying, kill your darlings, and you seem to have the Andy Griffith Show approach of bringing the darling family down and letting them run crazy through the town with banjo and mandolin. How have you pulled that off? How have you been able to get editors to let you just run wild as you have? Or are there many darlings that are dead in your background as well?
No, I don't think I've ever killed anyone. I love, they're your darlings, right? I don't know. I suppose my influences are different than most folks who've followed similar paths. The really formative years, I think, when you're writing, thinking, would probably be, for me, they would have been late 70s through early mid 80s. And my great influences at the time would have been the Beats, punk rock, the local colorists of the late 19th century, whom I read obsessively for years, and some of the new journalists of the 60s, and particularly Tom Wolfe. You know, and I just never had this idea that, I don't know, I wasn't interested in obeying the usual editorial strictures. And I think we have a lot more freedom than we think we do. A lot of times we assume that there are these boundaries that delimit what we can say. And for the most part, they're paper thin. You can just walk right through them.
Well, you've been doing that for quite a while, though I have to admit that sometimes with your verbal curveballs and changeups, I feel like if I can bat 400 with those, I'll make it into the Hall of Fame.
I make up a lot of these words, John. No. Really wrong with being an ideologist. You know, there's not like, you know, the lexicon police, the lexicon devils aren't going to come after me. So,
well, a lot of that decades of work is captured in a Front Porch Republic book with many of your old essays that's entitled Poetry Night at the Ballpark. Well, tell us where that title came from.
Well, this is when I was vice president of the KB Muck Dogs, and I hate the incessant noise at sporting events, and that includes you know, the walk up music and such, but even the between inning stuff I don't like. So anyway, the regular PA announcer was off, and so the club president was subbing for him, and so I said, you know what, instead of that crappy music, why don't we read poetry between innings and see how that goes. So he and I and our daughter, who was with then a band, I don't know, probably 10 or so, 12, and the head of the local library, we recorded, I guess it would have been 18-minute or less snippets of poetry about baseball. And it ranged from beats like Tom Clark to Grantland Rice and say some of the old-timers. I read, mine was something by, or one of the ones I did was by Charles Bukowski. And the only line I remember is, Jimmy Fox died an alcoholic in a Skid Row hotel room. I thought it was sort of a cautionary tale for the boys. And so anyway, so we had poetry night. And between innings, we had, when people were expecting the music, we had these poetry snippets over the PA system. And people are like, what the hell? And it was great because at one point, maybe about the fifth or sixth inning, the PA guy says, do you want more poetry or do you want music? And it was like the New Testament crowd crying, you know, free Barabbas, you know, music. But it's like, no, we're going to ram poetry. We're going to ram culture down your throats, which we did. So we did poetry all night. And it was, I'm sure it will never be repeated. But it was fantastic. It was fantastic. Another baseball story. I remember in 2008. Which is actually the year that we won the championship for the first time since 1963. They had Bill Kaufman night, which, you know, they were running out of special events, I guess. And so my daughter, who would have been, I guess, 14 at the time, she and her friend were going to sing the national anthem, you know. And at the time, places were doing God Bless America in the seventh inning stretch, you know. And I never liked that song. And so I told them, look, it's Bill Kaufman night. Sing my favorite, America the Beautiful. So Gretel and her friend Megan go out there and say, you know, seventh inning, and they start saying, oh, beautiful, for spacious skies. And some drunk from the beer tents starts heckling them, wrong song, wrong song. So I told them afterwards, they said, this is so cool. Like, you're the only people who've ever been heckled for singing America the Beautiful.
So what are you writing now? What keeps you busy? And how, I mean, I tried for a couple of years to make a living as a writer and soon found that lawyering paid better. You have made this work for now several decades. Who do you write for? Where can we find your stuff now?
I've written 11 books, wrote a feature film. It was made in 2013 called Copperhead by Ron Maxwell, who did a couple of great Civil War movies, including Gettysburg. And I've done screenplays that have not been filmed yet, but possibilities. But really, I mean, I'm a columnist for the the American Conservative and the Spectator, not the American Spectator, but rather the Spectator that's a hybrid of the venerable British publication, and they also have some American writers now. But really, I mean, really, over the years, for the most part, I mean, I've made most of my money editing for various editing for various magazines, editing for publishers, and also doing what I will euphemistically call very heavy editing.
AKA ghostwriting.
yeah, I don't I don't like to use that term, John. But heavy edit, really helping the author or the putative author
get their story out. It's their story.
Yeah, and you know, that's how I view it. Like, it's a craftsman like thing, and you know, so it's like I'm a carpenter. Somebody wants, hey, I want to do this table, so I help them make the table. Maybe it's not the table that I would make, but you know, I do my best, and so yeah, I do. These days, I didn't spend enough time earlier in my life making money, so I probably spend 3/4 of my time editing, and I do my columns, which is good. And one or two book ideas that I may or may not do. So actually, the most recent book I did would have been when I edited, which come out last year. I forget. It was the we had a congressman. It was later a very good friend of mine from 64 to 84 named Barbara Connable, who was on multiple occasions voted by his colleagues and staffers the most respected member of Congress. He was a Republican. He was ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee. He was just I was going to say Madison and the boys. I'm not a fan of James Madison, but if the founders could have chosen kind of a paragon of a congressman, they would have chosen Barbara Connable, who was brilliant, who was completely a man of his place. He would come back and give these fantastic extemporaneous lectures on local history and local culture. He was a man of like probity and rectitude. He refused to accept any campaign contribution of greater than $50, even in 1974, when the charismatic vice mayor of Rochester, Midge Costanza, whom coincidentally at the time, my brother and I were passing out handbills for Midge Costanza. But anyway, she was heavily subsidized by the labor movement, and it was the Watergate election. He refused to accept anything even then over $50. He was outstanding. Anyway, and he and I became very good friends later in his life, in his retirement. He actually did a term. He did a term at the World Bank after being congressman, and he told him, knowing of my point of view, he said, "Well, Bill, I was the decentralist president of the World Bank," which I don't know if that's possible. But anyway, his daughter told me I guess it was maybe 2017 or so. She said, "You know, my dad," and I knew this, that he had kept a journal for 17 of his 20 years in Congress, and it was embargoed. He'd read like little pieces to me, but it was at Cornell University. It was embargoed for, I forget how many years after his death, because he was very frank. She said, "You want to be the first person to read it in its entirety?" I said, "Oh yeah, I'd love to." So I did, and I was blown away. I mean, and anyway, University of Kansas Press, which is a very good political science press, published it, I guess it was last year, the journal. It's not that I'm trying to sell the book, but it really is unique in the annals of congressional literature. You have this brilliant guy who was a very good writer, although he dictated this, most of it, on a dictaphone, writing frankly about the inner workings of Congress. So part of it is like how a bill becomes a law from the inside over 17 years, and also these really interesting portraits of congressional eminences and also presidents. I mean, worked closely with Ford and Nixon and others. So I spent a lot of time on that. It was the journals were so light that they couldn't we couldn't reproduce them. So they're about 500,000 words. So I retyped it, and or the part we used, which is about 175,000 words or so. And it was like a total labor of love, but I think it's really good. But yeah, there's no books of mine on the horizon right now. But I will, if the Lord gives me a few more years, I will, I'm sure, disgorge one or two more.
And you've done a variety of work. You've done novels, travel writing, screenplays, as you mentioned. What, good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. What would you like to do with your final 40 years or so?
Thank you for saying that. I always wanted to write a, book about a movie book, which I may at some point. And I, my first book was a novel, and I always thought that maybe my last book, should be a novel. On the other hand, that would be kind of bad luck to say my last, you know. It's like if you have a bucket list, like when you cross the last thing off the bucket list, you're like, I'm screwed now. So, but yeah, the problem is I don't want it, it would be, it'd be difficult for it not to be collapse into a pool of sentiment, you know, if you're, when you're old. I mean, some people get just more curmudgeonly, and I hope I don't, I hope that doesn't happen to me. But so yeah, I think maybe I'll do a couple more books, I hope.
And I know you've at least got one more speech in you. Any hints on how you're going to close out this year's conference? And for those of us betting at home on the Batavia references over under, will this be yet another Batavia heavy speech?
Not as much, perhaps. I mean, I always like to talk a little bit about the host city, so I'll do that. And as you know, John, I tend to be very discursive, and to me, digressions are the most interesting part of any book or talk. So mostly I just want to wake the people up who've been put to sleep by Jason. That's my task.
Wake everyone up before we go to the bar.
Yeah, right.
Sadly, no Pat Moynihan to be there with us. Well, we look forward to seeing you there. Bill Kaufman, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. See you in Madison.
My thanks again to the man from Batavia. I hope to see many of you in Madison, Wisconsin, for a sold-out conference keynoted by Paul Kingsnorth and closed, as always, by the one and only Bill Kaufman. Until next time, thanks for pulling up a chair. Find your way home. Find your way home.